This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with author Alan Weissman. He has penned several books, including The World Without Us, an international bestseller. He's back with Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. With a million more of us every 4.5 days on a planet that's not getting any bigger, what are the chances of the Earth's survival? We'll discuss it with Alan Weissman. Also, big night at the Oscars for Louisiana. Big night. We'll talk about that with Pam Bordelon of the Baton Rouge Advocate, as well as what's happening on the party scene during the Mardi Gras season. Pam's right there amid all the fun and frivolity, and we'll talk with her. And the Advocate is now printing same-sex marriage announcements. Now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. 877-217-5757. Inkstershow at WRKF.org online. Frank Barnett is producing, and we begin the week with Alan Weissman, the author of several books, including The World Without Us, an international bestseller. He's back with Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. Good morning, Alan Weissman.
Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Doing well. And as you point out, there are 4.5 days, every 4.5 days, a million more people are on the Earth than there were the preceding 4.5 days. How can we sustain this?
Well, I don't think we can. The Earth doesn't keep growing, even though we do. And the more I got into this question, which, of course, is a very loaded question, and it's one that a lot of people shy away from, the idea of how many humans is a safe number for the planet Earth, I began to understand that even though life looks like kind of a normal situation to us every day, this is sort of what we were born into and are used to, we're really part of the most abnormal population growth in the history of biology. And at some point or other, nature's going to want to normalize things, and I think that there's an excellent chance for us to take control of that before nature does it to us.
You note that it took only 12 years for the population of the world to go from 6 billion to 7 billion, and the human population has quadrupled over the last 100 years. It would seem that at some point we'll have a breaking point.
Yeah, you would think so, and a lot of people feel that the breaking point has been reached. Seems like our world is bursting at its seams. If you believe, as the great consensus of scientists believe now, that the man-made energy that we use to propel our rather impressive technological civilization is now, unfortunately, sending its waste products up into the atmosphere, and that's affecting the weather, which is why you guys have been having some hard freezes down there in Louisiana, and why it's March in Massachusetts, where I'm speaking to you from, and it's going to be 5 below zero here tonight because the jet stream is now waving all over the place. Then, you know, for this book, I went to 21 different countries. I started in Israel and Palestine. I ended in Iran. And every single country I went to, the one thing they had in common is that the weather has completely changed on them. So it seems like what we do is starting to change the way the Earth performs. And, of course, the Earth didn't change an awful lot during the years, the thousands of years that our civilization formed, and that's kind of what we got used to. So either we're going to have to get used to something really new, or we're going to have to bring ourselves back in line with what kept nature a fairly secure and stable place for us.
297-5633 for Alan Weissman. The book is Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. As you know, Alan, there are people in public life, prominent people in the United States, who discount any notion of the population having something to do with the weather.
Well, there are prominent people, but I think they're prominent because they are shrill and they are strident. this is so reminiscent of the war, the tobacco wars in back in the 60s and 70s, when the American Tobacco Institute could always haul out some doctor on a well-padded salary who would say, well, you know, the research isn't completed. We need more data to see if there's any relationship between tobacco and lung cancer, because there are a lot of other variables that could be causing cancer, and people who don't smoke sometimes get cancer. But after a while, the overwhelming consensus of medical officials and scientists, and it was hitting 98%, 99%, and that's sort of where we are with the climate right now. You can track, mathematicians do this, accountants do this, you can track the increase in human use of fuel, fossil fuels, concentrated fuels, you know, fuels that nature has created for over millions and millions of years, but didn't need it to run the natural cycle. So bury that stuff away. Starting around 250 years ago, we started to unbury that stuff, dig it up in great quantities and burn it, and to create, you know, the jet-propelled society that we have today. And it's fabulous. I mean, you and I are talking to each other by means of electricity right now, though we're a couple of thousand miles apart. But there is a downside to it, and we haven't totally learned how to control that downside. So the downside floats up into the atmosphere, and the amount of carbon dioxide up there right now is higher than it has been for 3 million years. And 3 million years ago, the seas were 80 to 100 feet higher. And that would not bode well for the state of Louisiana or the state of Massachusetts, where I'm sitting.
Well, with so many people in prominent life discounting the premise that we have a problem at all, how difficult is it to get anything done?
Well, it's certainly a challenge, but that means that we have to simply work harder to bring a preponderance, an overwhelming preponderance of evidence to the table. Now, I'm a journalist. I'm not an activist for any cause. I simply took up this problem because to study to see whether it really was a problem. And if my publisher could vouch for me that I didn't promise any conclusions in my book proposal, simply to look to see what the truth was. But as I traveled the world, and I saw what it was happening in so many places, my personal store of evidence just became to be overwhelming. You know, I would be sitting in southern Pakistan where the sea level rises, and these sea level rises are being measured by satellites everywhere. They've been reported for a long time. You know, for 25 years now, we've known that the seas have been inching higher, but the Arabian Sea is now pushing its way up the mouth of the river of the Indus, one of the great rivers of India, of the Indian subcontinent, and every 2-3 years, another farming village in Pakistan finds that the water in its irrigation canals and in its wells is too saline to grow crops. Some of them actually turn to fishing saltwater species or brackish water species like mullet, but losing an enormous amount of farmland. And since I mentioned Pakistan, you know, that's a country that was one of the recipients of what many people thought was the proof that human technology can overcome any problem. And that the warnings of overpopulation by Malthus back in the end of the 18th century, and then by Paul and Ann Ehrlich with their controversial book, The Population Bomb, in the 1960s, that had been completely refuted by agricultural technology, the Green Revolution,
right,
which created crops that could grow much more food, you know, per stalk of wheat or rice. But in Pakistan, which was one of the first countries that received the benefits of those new crops and was saved from a famine, what happened was that those people then lived to beget more people who lived to beget more people. So now Pakistan's a country that has nearly 190 million people in it. It's about the size of Texas. Texas has 26 million people in it. By the middle of the century, it will have close to 400 million people in it. That's many more than the United States has right now.
Well, you're throwing out a lot of numbers, and the numbers are important. In nearly 200,000 years since Homo sapiens first appeared in our population, it took that long to get to 1 billion people in 1815. We now have seven times that in the world. And in China alone, there are, Alan, you note, I think 150 cities with more than 1 million people in China.
Yeah, and by about 2030, there's going to be around 260. I mean, most Chinese don't even know the names of most of the cities, most of the biggest cities in their country. They're just filling up so fast. And India, the other recipient, along with Pakistan, of the Green Revolution miracle, is about to surpass China this coming decade as the most populous nation on Earth. So we're talking about a lot of people. And you know, your listeners might be wondering, so what happened in the last century to make this suddenly spurt so quickly? And two things happened. In the 19th century, we got to be very good at medicine. Smallpox vaccine was invented around the beginning of the 19th century, and that was followed by more vaccines, the use of antiseptics, pasteurization of milk, wiping out some epidemic-bearing insects, and suddenly people were living longer, but more important, people were not dying so young. It used to be that babies, most babies didn't make it to their fifth birthday, if you can imagine the pain of our ancestors. And life expectancy was 40 years on average. But now suddenly we live a lot longer and a lot more babies survive, which is a really wonderful thing, of course. But as many began to realize, if we're going to cure all these diseases, we need to do something about the population spurt that accompanies it. Well, the population really began to spurt in the 20th century with increased food production. I already mentioned the Green Revolution, but before that, probably the single most important invention in human history was something called the Haber-Bosch process, which was a way of pulling nitrogen out of the air and chemically spreading it on the land. Before, it was just some nitrogen-fixing plants like legumes that could contribute that important nutrient, and that limited the amount of plant life on the planet. But we blew the lid off of what nature could do, and as a result, there are our population doubled and then doubled again in a single century.
All right. Well, what can be done?
Here we are today.
What can be done quickly to thwart this kind of explosive growth?
Well, you know, you mentioned China, and everybody thinks that the first thing that comes to mind is, you know, China's one-child policy, but nobody wants to participate in that. You don't want a government coming in telling you what to do in your private life because, you know, look, procreation is something that comes naturally. Nature made us and every other organism to make copies of ourselves. And fortunately, what I found in this book is that there are many examples all over the world of countries that made it very attractive for people to have smaller children or smaller families, fewer children, by simply making contraception available to them and letting the people decide for themselves. It's an individual decision. And contraception, fortunately, doesn't involve any technological leap. We already know how to do this, and we keep getting better at it. In Countdown, I talk about the new male contraceptives that are coming online, chemically very simple and all reversible. If contraception were available worldwide, because right now there's a shortage for about a quarter of a billion women out there, but if it was available worldwide so every woman could decide how many children she wanted to have, that would cost us about a little over $8 billion a year, which is less than your country and mine was spending in Iraq and Afghanistan per month for most of the past decade. I mean, this is not very expensive stuff.
We'll return and spend a few more minutes with Alan Weissman and then hear from Pam Bordelon of The Advocate and Pam's Party Line back in after this 90-second timeout. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Hope you're enjoying your Mardi Gras season. We'll hear more about that from Pam Bordelon of The Advocate in just a few moments. But we've got a little time left with Alan Weissman. His book is Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. Bill Strieber, the author of Cold and Heat, says Countdown converts globe-trotting research into flowing journalism, highlighting a simple truth there quite plainly too many of us. A world that understands Weissman's words will understand the pressing need for change. We've got 7 billion people and counting on the Earth right now. What would be the ideal number of people to be on the planet?
Well, it's calculated a couple of different ways in my book. One is by how much carbon dioxide per person. First, do we need so everybody can have a reasonably acceptable life? And then how much can the atmosphere tolerate before it starts destabilizing not just our climate systems, but also the chemistry of the seas? And, you know, you can talk to your oyster fishermen and along the Gulf Coast there to know that oyster larvae are starting to struggle because as the seas get more acidic, it starts to affect their the formation of their shells. And that number harkens back to the time around the beginning to the first third of the 20th century when there were between 1.5 billion and a two billion of us. And interestingly, another calculation, which is looking at how we grow our crops, points out that before we started force-feeding our agriculture with chemistry, commercializing nitrogen-based fertilizer, we had about 2 billion people on the planet. Now, what we don't want to do is start culling everybody, of course. This is something, a change that can take place gradually. But it isn't really very onerous. If families average 2 children or fewer for the next couple of generations, we would, once the last overgrown generations pass on, we would start coming rather rapidly down to a nice sustainable size that wouldn't involve, you know, now there's a growing body of evidence about how all that chemistry is doing everything from, you know, destroying the marine ecology in the Gulf of Mexico down there at the base of the Mississippi and the rest of the world's large rivers with all that nitrogen runoff, to, you know, links to everything from autism to breast cancer because of all the chemical protectant pesticides and herbicides that are used to accompany these technological laboratory bred crops that we have. We could start phasing out a lot of toxic chemistry from our food supply. We would be healthier. We'd have more room for us and more room for other species. It's known very well that we depend on a robust, healthy natural ecosystem out there, but 40% of the terrestrial planet right now is devoted to feeding ourselves. It doesn't leave a lot of room for other creatures out there. So all of this over the next couple of centuries could gradually get healthier and healthier with each coming decade. And it just simply means making contraception available to people. And by the way, lots of people ask me about, you know, well, is this advocating abortion? You know, I don't know anybody who really enjoys the idea of abortion. Right now, with half the pregnancies, both in the United States and worldwide, being unintended, there's a lot of abortion in the world. And I talked to 3 different demographic institutes about this question. They estimate 40 million abortions in the world every year. But if contraception were universally available, that number would come down to about 14 million abortions. And to me, that's the best anti-abortion program possible. That would save us 36 million abortions a year. So making contraception available just seems to me to be the most sensible thing, regardless of anybody's political persuasions.
All right. Well, the book is Countdown by Alan Weissman, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. And Alan's overriding message is that Earth control can be achieved by birth control. Thank you, Alan. Good to talk with you.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye. We're joined in studio now by Pam Bordelon, social columnist, intrepid reporter, Pam's Party Line, the Baton Rouge Advocate. You had a big weekend.
I did. It was the wrap-up of the local Mardi Gras scene here in the capital city.
You were involved in the Spanish Town event, weren't you?
Yeah, the Advocate did its, we debuted an online stream of the Spanish Town Parade live from Spanish Town Road, and it was quite an adventure, as the Spanish Town Parade always is. Mm-hmm. So, but it was a lot of fun. It went very well. So we may be doing a little more of that kind of stuff.
Well, and you participated.
I did my very best Katie Couric narration of the floats and tried to see how many euphemisms I could throw out there to describe them. It was quite the challenge. This is not quite like doing the Macy's Day Parade, I promise you.
No. I read in the Advocate today that somebody was injured falling off one of the floats.
Oh, that must have happened after they passed by us.
Yeah.
Gosh.
But hopefully nothing serious.
I hope not.
There is some consumption of adult beverages going on.
Just a little bit. It's a big party. It's one big party.
Yeah, we like to party. We like to take days off.
Yes,
it's
we do.
It's like a ghost town here
this
morning.
It's like a straight shot to get here.
And, if there's a light mist, the governor shuts down state offices, right?
Well, it might freeze.
It might freeze tonight.
I know.
But Pam will be there reporting everything that goes on in this community from a social perspective. And last night we had the Oscars, and it was hosted by Louisiana's Ellen DeGeneres.
She did a great job.
She did, although she made one joke about Liza Minnelli that will probably not endear her to Miss Minnelli for some time.
But, possibly not.
Those things happen. But I thought Seth MacFarlane did a nice job last year, but I don't think he was invited back. Ellen, I think she'll be back.
I think so.
But it's nice for Louisiana to have such representation. And the winners, chock full of Louisiana.
Yes, I think entities. The state was represented, came out very well, very well.
Well, let's start with Best Picture, 12 Years a Slave. Yep. After being published in several editions in the 19th century, the book fell into obscurity for a century, rediscovered by two Louisiana historians, Sue Eakin of Louisiana State University and Joseph Logsdon of the University of New Orleans. And in the early 1960s, they researched and retraced Solomon Northrop's journey and co-edited a historically annotated version published by LSU Press in 1968. So
wow.
LSU Press, I don't think, has gotten enough credit for producing this great work.
I'm not sure I realized that they had done that.
Have you seen the movie?
I have not seen the movie, but I really that is on my to-do list.
Well, it's an important
film. I've heard it's a very powerful film.
Powerful. Not a lot of laughs, but but a searing depiction of slavery.
Sounds like something everyone needs to see.
That's right. But the best actor, Matthew McConaughey, Dallas Buyers Club.
I did see that. I did
filmed
see Dallas
in Louisiana.
Yeah.
And joined by Jared Leto as the best supporting actor.
Yes.
And the best actress, supporting actress rather, was Lupita. I think her last name is Nyong.
Yes.
12 Years a Slave.
Yeah.
So Louisiana having great representation at the Oscars. And the best score was from Gravity.
Mm-hmm.
And Victor Saxe of Centaur Records produced the music for the trailer of Gravity, based right here in Baton Rouge.
Wow.
So how about Louisiana?
We did real well last night.
How about that, Pam?
It's not often we get to shout about really good stuff that we do on a national level. It's kind of a nice switch, isn't it?
It is. And I think quite often we beat ourselves up, and we shouldn't. But you usually report about fun things.
I have one of the more pleasant jobs, and then I get to talk about the happy news in town.
And there is a lot of happy news, and we're a town that loves to party with a vibrant social scene. You have several events a week, don't you?
I do.
How do you keep up this pace?
You see this little book right here?
Yeah.
If it's not written down in this little black book here, which stays by my side, it doesn't get covered, because this is my Bible right here. It's my life.
Right. So here you are, 9:31 with us this morning, and quite likely Pam will be out tonight to cover
No, not tonight. Everybody's in New Orleans partying in the big easy.
And all this stuff over the weekend was accompanied by a new arrival in your family, right?
Yes, I have a new granddaughter. Okay. So in between all of my popping around, I'm not doing our part to contribute to the explosion of people on the earth here. But I'm not sending her back. She has to stay.
Well, I don't think we're talking about extermination. We're talking about too many people being born.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think there's a way to address that beyond getting rid of your granddaughter.
There is. But anyway, she's precious and she's...
What is her name?
Her name is Sophia Agnes Lee Kennan.
So, very good.
Glad she's here.
Very good. 297-5633 is your number if you'd like to talk with Pam Bordelon of The Advocate. And we do have a question here from Heather about how The Advocate, now with the presence all over the state, including New Orleans, how does that affect what you do?
It doesn't really affect me. We have we hired Nell Nolan, a longtime social queen of New Orleans, to cover the social scene down there for us. And so I was going back and forth for a little bit when the Manship family first went down that way. But now that we have a separate newspaper down that way, Miss Nolan covers the social happenings down there for us. And then we recently hired Patricia Gannon over in Lafayette to kind of take care of the Lafayette scene for us. So we had rapport there, and I had gone over and visited a couple of times over in Lafayette, but we've got that covered. So,
well, you got three people in the big three cities in South Louisiana.
That's it. So,
well, but nobody covers Baton Rouge like Pam Bordelon. Well, and I noticed, and this goes back to a previous visit you had with us on the show, and you actually touted this to me quite proudly, that The Advocate is now printing same-sex marriage announcements.
Well, we actually had one about 3 weeks ago. Said there was a couple that was married in a state that was where same-sex marriage was legal. And now that weddings are basically a paid advertisement, it's not a free service anymore. It does not go through the editorial end of the paper. It is a paid service. So if it's done in a state that is legal, and
The Advocate will print
you're
it.
Willing to pay to put it in there, then we're willing to print it. So.
Well, there is some aversion to this in Louisiana, as we know, so I would imagine The Advocate got some criticism.
We did not get any comments at all.
None. Well, good. That's encouraging.
Yes, it is.
Maybe nobody noticed, but I'm sure some people did.
Yeah.
People that, in fact, some folks read that section more diligently and religiously than any other.
I like to think that that's one of the most well-read sections of the newspaper. I think sports may be number one, but maybe we're number two.
Well, and there's no doubt that people read your column.
I have to say, yes, they do, because they quote it back to me as I'm in the grocery store or wherever.
And the few times I've been honored to be mentioned in your column, I have people far and wide say, hey. Got a shout out from Pam Bordelon, so I'm always pleased to be in Pam's column, at least so far.
Like having you in there.
Well, but what's the most fun thing to cover?
Oh, that's a hard question to answer. There are so many fun events, and I guess the best way to answer that is to tell you about some of my favorite ones that are coming up.
Okay.
The Best Dressed Ball, which benefits the American Cancer Society.
How do you get on that list?
You get nominated, and then there's a panel of people that they send out a ballot to vote, mm-hmm. and then they the committee tallies the ballots to see who gets
the committee.
The most
You're
votes.
On the committee?
I'm one of the voters. I vote, so I'm,
so
I'm
when,
not a
when
nominator.
You get nominated,
but I vote.
You have to have some kind of portfolio? Is that?
I'm not real sure. I'm not part of the nominating mm-hmm. process, so I'm not real sure mm-hmm. how that goes. But I am a voting, I guess, member of the.
Well, it helps to be a prominent member of the community, but it also helps to be somebody who looks good, and we have some folks who take great pride in how they appear and cut a swath that is impressive enough that they get recognized. How many years have you done this?
I've been voting now, let's see, probably about 10 years now, I guess, I've been voting for Best Dressed.
10 years, so it's been going on for some time.
Oh, the event has been going on for almost 50 years now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's been going on for a long time.
Now, you're always elegantly dressed wherever
you
go, including this morning. There must be some kind of dress code for the social critic.
You just kind of have to keep up with the Joneses. And I don't have their budget, so I have to get very creative.
Well, you do it well.
Thank you.
But I know at Channel 2, for example, a few years back, one of their reporters got suspended for wearing blue jeans to an event. You don't have any rules like that, do you?
No, I try to dress appropriate for whatever the event is. So if it's a casual event, that I have what I call my dressy jeans. So if it's an event that kind of attire would be appropriate, then I try to fit in with the crowd, whatever the dress for the event. So,
well, you have some experience doing this, and you choked me up so much that I dropped my microphone. But Pam makes an impression when she walks in a room, and of course, it's nice to be mentioned in her column. And I'm just looking at yesterday. You must have 200 or 300 people mentioned. So you have a lot of names to keep track of, don't you?
We like to do a lot of name dropping and shout outs to people. So because that's what makes it fun to read is people like to see what friend of theirs might be mentioned in there. So.
You mentioned Washington Mardi Gras. Have you ever been to?
I have not been, but I'm going one day, soon.
but here in Baton Rouge, there are, do you know how many Mardi Gras celebrations there are?
Ooh, I would say there probably are about 20 crews, if you count all of them, in the greater Baton Rouge area.
20.
At least, yes.
And the Spanish Town affair has now become something that is recognized all over the country.
I was going to say it's got to be nationally, probably internationally known at this stage of the game. Yeah.
What makes it so special?
It kind of throws all the rules out the window. It's it pokes fun at the rest of the gang. It's very irreverent. It amazes me every year how the themes that they can come up with. You wonder, okay, how are they going to top what they did last year? And somehow they always manage to do it. There's always lots of.
By the way, who was the king and queen this year?
Gil Leachman was the king, and Lakin Boudreaux was the queen, and Lieutenant Governor Jay Darden was the grand marshal.
He was with us last week. He wants to be governor. Another governor from Baton Rouge High. Imagine that.
Could
happen. We'll talk about it. Well, we'll talk about perhaps some other things with Pam Bordelon. And there's much to discuss with her. If you'd like to join us, 297-5633. Back in 90 seconds on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. A few more minutes with Pam Bordelon of The Advocate. She does Pam's Party Line. Used to be at In Register, so you've covered the social scene for some time.
20 years. This past October 20, was 20 years
20
of party
years.
Hopping.
All right. RJ in North Baton Rouge. RJ, you're on with Pam.
Pam, quick question for you. In the African-American church, the ministers are very, very well-dressed guys. And also, many of the ladies love wearing hats, particularly around the Easter season. How much of that gets covered in the Advocate, please?
I don't know, but that might be a good little Easter story for us to do. Is the ladies in their hats, because they are quite something.
Mm-hmm. Do you wear hats on occasion?
I gave up hats when I left In Register because we were known as the Hat Ladies, and I kind of parked my hats when I came over to the Advocate.
But ministers quite often are dashing figures.
Yes, they are.
And someone online, Tara, notes that the mayor president cuts an impressive visage.
Yes,
and the rest
and
of them.
Actually, he has been on the best dressed list. He has been honored as one of the city's best dressed.
But Manuel Martinez, who knows well-dressed man when he sees one. He says the mayor dresses more like an entertainer than a statesman.
Yes, he's a little more on the cutting edge of fashion than your typical politician.
Okay. Paul in Opelousas. Paul, good morning. You're on with Pam.
Morning. Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Pam. I don't know if you covered it, and I want to call it this morning. Louisiana was well represented last night at the Oscars.
We talked about that. Where were you?
I was in the road working. I just want to propose that we invite everybody who won from Louisiana back to Louisiana and celebrate it.
All right.
I think we should do it.
That would be the perfect party, and I would gladly go cover that one.
Well, we are certainly a film titan right now in Louisiana, and we should shout from the rooftops about how this phenomenon has taken root. Here, Best Picture, Best Actor,
Best Supporting Actor,
Best Supporting Actress, and probably could have won a few others, but the fact that 12 Years a Slave won is something LSU should certainly proclaim. And then she say, yeah, there's been very little publicity about LSU Press publishing this book in 1968.
Yeah, which is an amazing part of LSU. LSU Press is just, they do some wonderful stuff that people don't always realize that's where it came from.
Well, 297-5633 is your number with Pam Bordelon. A few more minutes with Pam's Party Lines writer. You enjoy what you do, don't you?
I love my job. I think I have one of the best jobs in the city. I get to meet some amazing people, not just celebrities that I get to cross paths with, but people who live here and that are members of our community that I probably would not get to know any other way if I didn't do this. And I have to say, Baton Rouge is an amazing city with some amazing people that live here.
We have quite a city, and it's because it's involved with education, state government. Many people come here and stay here from other places and stay here a long time. And yet we still have, I think, over three-quarters of us were born here. I wasn't, but were you?
No, I'm not a native.
You know, in Los Angeles, I saw the other day, only 25% of the people who live there were born in that city.
Oh,
so,
wow.
So we have about three times the number of people who were actually born here who stay here. But because it's a university town, Southern and LSU most prominently, we have some people who come from other parts and enrich our culture.
Yes.
But generally, they embrace the culture as well.
Yes, they do.
I doubt that there's a Spanish town Mardi Gras in Topeka, Kansas.
I don't think so, but I'm thinking the people from Topeka, Kansas that come down here and see it love it.
And they probably love when Pam writes about it. We got a few other questions.
Okay.
I know The Advocate has followed suit with other newspapers, but Kristen asked, when did weddings start? When did it start having a charge to have a premium?
I started there about 5.5 years ago, and they had started doing it right about the time that I started there. So it's been about five going on probably close to 6 years now.
And another listener writes about your coverage of Edwin Edwards. It seems he's become quite a social butterfly.
Yes, he has. He has become quite the social butterfly. So, of course, now that he's contemplating running for office, we know why. He's not just peddling books now. So,
but he always, I don't see him anywhere now without his wife.
No,
you know, in the old days, I used to see him going solo quite a bit, but not anymore.
No, Trina is always with him when they travel together.
And it's hard to believe that he's almost 87. He's the same age as Sidney Poitier, who was at the Oscars last night.
Yeah.
Regal man. He commands, has a presence that is that is amazing. But he was moving slow.
Yeah, he looked.
He was really moving slow.
87 last night.
But Edwin, he's just getting started, or so it seems. Charles on Jefferson. Hi, Charles. You're on with Pam.
Yes, I just wanted to recommend a book you might want to read about Louisiana. It's based in the Tankerville area in the 1890s. It's called Land O' Sugar, and it gives a wonderful portrayal of what life was like back then. So just something to maybe get somebody to read and do something with.
Who's the author?
The last name is Johnson. I think it's Ann Johnson. I'm not sure. It's written in about 1963. It's in the Louisiana section of the library.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. Well, check that one out.
Yeah. Well, but Louisiana here in the throes of Mardi Gras should be very proud that one of our own, Ellen DeGeneres, hosted the Oscars so well that she quite likely will be back. Did they really break some kind of Twitter record last night with that photo?
I would think so. There were enough stars in it that it should have broken the record without a whole lot of trouble.
Yeah, well, she was born in January of 1958 in New Orleans. The same month, same year as Marc Morial, the former mayor, who's now head of the Urban League, and Donna Rice.
Oh, wow.
The woman who changed history by cavorting with Gary Hart on the monkey business. If not for that, I think Gary Hart would have been elected president in 1988. We wouldn't have had George H.W. Bush. We wouldn't have had Bill Clinton. We wouldn't have had Bush II, and we wouldn't have had Barack Obama. So Donna Rice, same month, same year, New Orleans, as Ellen DeGeneres. She changed the course of history,
didn't
Pam Bordelon. You're grimacing.
Wow. I'm just like the domino effect, huh? You were talking about celebrities. Yeah. I got a text message from a friend of mine who was celebrating his birthday at Jubin's the other night and ran into Danny Glover.
Danny Glover.
Danny Glover was
Lethal in town. Weapon.
Yes, yes. He's been in town shooting a movie, so he got to take his picture for his birthday picture with Mr. Danny Glover.
Well, you never know who's going to pop in.
No, you don't. Richard Dreyfuss has been just left town. He's been in town filming Zipper, so he's been spotted out and about.
Fine actor.
Celebrity sightings are becoming...
What's your favorite Richard Dreyfuss movie?
Mr. Holland's Opus.
That was a good one. I like Tin Men.
I don't think I saw that one. I like the movie Always he did with Holly Hunter, too. I think that was really good.
Yeah, he's had a few good ones.
He has.
He was in American Graffiti. That was a long time ago.
Yeah, that was a long, and I love that movie.
41 years ago.
That movie.
41 years ago.
Okay, I was about to tell you that movie came out when I'm my freshman year in college. Because we went to see it twice.
We're going to let you go here in a minute. But LD wants to know if Bobby Jindal has been as visible at public events and these social gatherings that you cover as previous governors.
No, he has not. He has not. Previous governors have had a lot of events at the governor's mansion. And so they would frequently pop in and you would, you know, there would be photos of them with whatever organization. But there have not, that has all scaled back tremendously under the Jindal administration.
Any reason why?
I think probably because they have young children that go to bed at night.
Well, he could come out. You know, I used to see Edwin when I was in school. I'd see him on Sorority Row.
I bet.
LSU Union. Mm-hmm. And he was going solo in those days.
Yep.
But not anymore. He doesn't go anywhere without Trina.
Nope.
Who's good for his image, I think.
I think so.
And who knows, he may be returning to Congress 50 years after he first arrived. That would be quite a story.
That would be quite the story. Quite the story. And there are a lot of folks out there that say they're going to vote for him. So we shall see.
And I think he's running. It's March 3rd. I'll make a prediction that by the end of the month, Edwin Edwards will be an official candidate for the 6th District of the U.S. House of Representatives, the great state of Louisiana. You know, the other night, I saw Richard Baker, and I didn't even realize it was Richard Baker. We said hello, and I don't know if he recognized me. And I thought, gee, I know that guy from somewhere. And as he walked away and drove away in his Mercedes, I realized that was Richard Baker, the guy who represented Louisiana in the U.S. House of Representatives from 1987 to 2008.
He was in office for a long
21
time.
21 years he was in Congress. Good. He looks good, too.
Good, because I haven't seen him in forever.
But now head of the National Hedge Fund Association in Washington, D.C., and it's nice that he spends some time in his hometown.
Came back home for a little bit.
Yeah.
Huh? Okay.
Well, thank you, Pam Bordelon.
Thank you, Jim. It's
good to
it
see you.
It was a pleasure.
And we're joined in our remaining time some people involved in a significant production not far away from where we are right now. Good morning, Brian Breen.
Good morning, Jim.
And tell us about To Kill a Mockingbird.
Well, To Kill a Mockingbird, of course, is a classic story that almost every high school student has to read. And those of a certain age, like you and I, know the movie very well. But this is a stage production at Ascension Community Theater that opens this Thursday, March the 6th. And we'll bring Harper Lee's novel to life on the stage.
Well, it's a great book, as we know, just like 12 Years a Slave, and it was made into a great movie, and it's a little hard to top Gregory Peck, isn't it?
We might come close here. We have a wonderful actor named Sam Bryan who'll be playing Atticus Finch for us, and he'll gives his own take on Atticus. He's not doing doing Gregory Peck, nor should he.
We've got Sam, who's a little younger than Gregory. But To Kill a Mockingbird opens Thursday,
March the 6th.
At the Ascension Community Theater, which is located...
That's on Felicity Street in Gonzales, Louisiana, 823 Felicity Street. It's just a block off of Burnside Avenue, which is
okay,
really
the main drag
right there in Gonzales. Okay. The phone number, would you like that?
Yes, certainly.
All right, the phone number for tickets is 225-647-1230.
And it runs through the 16th.
It does run through the 16th.
Okay. Well, you've got Sam Bryan here, who's a young guy, commanding like Atticus and Gregory. Good morning, Sam.
Good morning.
Get a little closer here.
All right.
Well, this is a challenging role.
Certainly. It is a very challenging role. And I think it's interesting that you say nothing like Gregory Peck, and I certainly hope not, because I don't want to try to be Gregory Peck. Obviously, that's not those are big shoes to fill. But I think it's such a complex script and story that it's easy enough for me to find my own take on it. So you won't see Gregory Peck, but you will see the best possible story I could get out of the script.
So do you try to make him look older?
Oh, we do. We actually we have a professional makeup artist actually on the staff. So,
because he's a you know, nice looking guy, but he's a young man, and I imagine Atticus as being a little bit older.
A little bit, but once you see Sam interacting,
Sam becomes Atticus.
He does.
I never would have thought that Anthony Hopkins could be Richard Nixon, but he pulled it off.
He sure did.
So. I'm sure you read the book as a
yes, absolutely. I read the book when I was younger. I obviously seen the movie a handful of times when I was younger, also. But yeah, this should be an interesting play, and I think everybody should get the chance to come.
Where are you
it.
From, Sam?
I'm from Baton Rouge.
From Baton Rouge,
yes, sir.
Where'd you go to school?
I was homeschooled, actually.
Really?
Yes, sir.
So, how'd you get the acting bug?
Oh, I think my mom would tell you that I was born with it. I was always. I was telling somebody the other day I had more costumes than I had normal clothes. I said I was revealing too much about myself, but yeah, I think it was born with it.
Okay. And Brian, you have another member of the cast who's not too far away.
This is
sashaying down the hall.
Here she is. This is Maddie Olson.
Maddie, come a little closer. Maddie's coming through the door now. Yeah, that's right.
Maddie's a longtime member of our theater board, and she's also playing the character of Mrs. DuBose in the play.
That's an important role. And Maddie, good to have you with us.
Good morning.
Sounds like it's going to be an outstanding production.
Yes, I'm thrilled that we're doing To Kill a Mockingbird at Ascension Community Theater.
Okay, well, you've been in... other plays, as we know, but have you ever been in this one?
Well, actually, no, I've not been in To Kill a Mockingbird before, and this is fun for me to get back on the stage after so many years. I've been directing plays at Ascension Community Theater since we started in 1999.
Mm-hmm. Well, Brian, well, the expectations of the audience are always going to be high for To Kill a Mockingbird because so many people are familiar with the story and have mm-hmm. seen other productions, so the bar is set high from the very beginning.
Certainly it is, and I think we'll definitely meet the bar. This is going to be an entertaining production from start to finish. And once you see Sam's Atticus when he's interacting with our wonderful children, we have such wonderful mm-hmm. child actors mm-hmm. in this play. You'll immediately believe it, and it's just riveting from start to finish. We have a wonderful Tom Robinson as well.
Why do you think that story still has relevance more than 50 years after it was published?
Oh, it's it really is as meaningful today as it was when it was written. And it's a story of prejudice through ignorance, and we can still be just as ignorant as we were in 1935. based purely on the fact that we just don't know. There's themes throughout the play that extend far beyond racism, whereas racism is very prevalent theme in the play. It's it has more to do with just not knowing some other people. You just don't know people until you meet them, until you see them. And it's a father's struggle to teach his children that.
Well, good luck.
Thank you.
Sam Bryan, Maddie Olson, and Brian Breen. And if you'd like for more information about this production of To Kill a Mockingbird at the Ascension Theater, Community Theater, please call 225-647-1230. Until tomorrow, for Frank Barnett, I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening.
And podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.